They say, the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:03. Too early, guys. Come on. Wednesday, January 19th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. John is off this week, and it's a very slow news week for racing. So I hope you don't mind if we just talk to our guest co-host about the NFL playoffs for like 45 minutes.
That's fine. I'm ready for it.
We'll get to that in just a minute. I'm Bill Finley, correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. So John's off this week. Joe, next week you're going to be off. Here I am, week after week, the Cal Ripken of the TDN Writers Room broadcast.
The Iron Man.
And I'm the substitute, Randy Moss, with NBC Sports. As Joe alluded to, I've also done quite a bit of work for NFL Network over the years. So I've been religiously watching all these playoff games as well.
That takes a lot of commitment because there were a lot of blowouts this weekend. If you were religiously watching those.
It was tough at times. It was a tough watch on several of those, yeah. Hopefully it'll be more competitive as we go on.
I think it will. So thanks to Randy for joining us. Looking forward to the show. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Keeneland Spring Meet returns April 8th through the 29th. New Keeneland Select accounts that wager $300 in the first 30 days earn $100 back with their sign-up bonus. Visit KeenelandSelect.com to sign up. So as I alluded to in the open, it's not a huge news week for racing. I scrambled for a couple of topics this week, but Michael Baychuk gave us one. If you don't know Michael Baychuk, he's a pretty high-profile horse player. He won the NHC a couple of years ago. He was spearheading the class action lawsuit against Bob Baffert over the Derby, talking about all the money that was cost people who had Mandaloon, which included me. I would have had like a $7,000 pick for if Mandaloon had won that race. Had not joined the suit yet. I'm still waiting to see how it shakes out. But it seems like that suit isn't really going to succeed. And Baychuk said this week that he was so disgusted by Bob Baffert and by what he sees as rampant cheating in racing that he says he's going to leave. He says he's not going to play the horses anymore, really. He's going to focus mostly on sports betting, which has just become legal in a lot of different states. And I have a little bit of a personal story about that. I wonder if this is kind of a canary in the coal mine for racing, because even though the handle numbers are good, we discussed last week, we debated whether or not that was just increased wagering from the CAW wagers, whether it was true growth. I think there are a lot of people, especially high profile people and people that have kind of made a living in this game, who are sick of it, who are sick of getting beaten by cheaters and juice jobs. And, you know, I've certainly had those frustrations over the years. But you guys play the horses. I'm wondering what Bill and Randy think, if this is kind of, you think that there might be a trend or if this is just a one-off?
Well, whether there's going to be a trend or not, Joe, and we'll find out. Let's hope that people that run horse racing listen to Michael Baychuk, because I think he does represent you know, people who, like you said, are fed up. And back in 1964, the Michael Baychuks of the world had no alternatives. You either bet on horses or you didn't gamble. Or, you know, you might have gone to Las Vegas. That was it. Now, as he mentioned, he also said there's daily fantasy sports in Louisiana. Like so many other states, their sports wagering is on its way. And as a consumer, he is, among other things, you know, let's put aside the fact that he's fed up and the whole Baffert thing. If you're a consumer and you like to gamble, would you rather gamble on something where the takeout is 20%, or would you rather bet on something where the takeout is 6% or what have you, and is something that is immensely more popular and more well-known than horse racing, the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, whatsoever? So he said, I'm a consumer. This is horse racing does not offer me the best product. So that's number one. And number two, yeah, he is disgusted. And I'm sure he said he would have won more than $50,000 if Mandaloon had won the Kentucky Derby. And, you know, if I were in his shoes, I would be very disgusted too. I don't know if I would have sued Bob Baffert like he did, but, you know, those things do leave an awful bad taste in your mouth. So, you know, he said he's absolutely had it. He's out. And the question is, how many more Michael Baychuks in the world are out there? And, you know, looking back on it, I'm surprised he didn't even bring up what I think is an even more important issue than the issues he brought up. And I talk a lot about this because I think it's very important, is the computer-assisted wagering. you know, these guys are cleaning everybody else's clock. And, you know, if you're not playing with the computers and the algorithms, you're going up against competition that you just can't beat, which makes the game so much more tougher than it was before these guys came around. So, yeah, are there more Michael Baychucks? We don't know. We will see. But horse racing industry leaders, please listen to this guy.
Yeah, I think Bill just sort of drilled down to the key issues there. Not so much the specific issues that this suit represents, but just the overall lack of respect, representation, whatever, that horse players have gotten from racetracks and from the horse racing industry over the years, with the takeout, with the breakage, things like that. I mean, horse players need to have a bigger voice. They need to be listened to more than they are now. And hopefully we'll see that going forward. I don't know Michael. Maybe I've met him. I don't know if I have or not. I haven't talked to him about this. I doubt if he thinks he's got any chance at all to win this suit. I think it's probably more symbolic, trying to make a moral point, trying to take a stand more than anything else. It's a little like suing horse players getting together for a class action suit as the result of what they perceive to be a bad steward's call. Or we talked about the NFL suing because of a bad officiating call that you think knocks you out of a wager. You know, not much of a chance, I think, for that to succeed. I will say this. I'm always on the side of the horse player. I do take minor exception, really more than minor exception, to something that Michael did say when he sort of lumped Bob Baffert in with Jorge Navarro and Jason Service in one particular sentence that he pointed out as to why he's so frustrated with the sport. I do think we have a drug problem in the sport. Obviously, Baffert has been at fault with the overages, the medication overages that we've seen with Medina Spirit, Gamine, and other horses. I would hesitate to put Baffert in that category, but I can certainly understand his frustration at having bet on Mandaloon or whoever else he might have bet on in that Kentucky Derby.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. I wanted to read the quote from Michael Baychuck, and because I think it's kind of representative of how a lot of people feel in the business. He says, "I'm just fed up with the drug cheating. I'm fed up with the takeout. I'm fed up that we apparently can't get into a position to implement new and better drug testing. I have more outlets now to gamble. I live in Louisiana, which was a state up until last year where the only thing available was horse racing. Now there's daily fantasy sports, and the takeout is much, much better. Soon they'll have online sports betting. I am a consumer. I have just found better products." It's hard to argue with any of that, honestly. And it's the kind of thing that I feel, you know, not necessarily on a day-to-day basis in racing, but just overall, it kind of feel the same way. And, you know, over the weekend, on Sunday, or it was either Saturday or Sunday, I was alive in like a Aqueduct Pick Four, and it was for decent money. And I don't know if this has ever happened to you guys, but I had a single in the last leg. Horse was 6-5 in the morning line. Probably should have been 4-5 or so at post. And the horse opens up at like 5-2. And I was like, I know I'm screwed. I absolutely know I'm screwed, because when those horses open up that cold on the board, they hardly ever win. The horse lost. And it gave me a bad taste in my mouth. So you know what I did the rest of the day? I opened up my FanDuel Sportsbook, and I just bet on the NFL and basketball. And I did not place a single horse racing wager the rest of the day. And that's not necessarily one of these egregious things where you feel like you've been wronged or it's unjust. But it doesn't take a lot. Honestly, now that sports betting is legal, I don't think it's going to take a lot to push people in that direction. A, it's easier. There's a million things going on. It's not as intricate of a handicapping process. You can just pop on the TV. You can do live betting. You know, you can see how the game is going and then decide to put a bet in. It's just so much more accessible and so much, I don't know, just so much more simple, I would say, than betting on the horses. And I just think that there is that kind of danger that you push people who have been supporting the game for so long to the edge when they finally now have different options. You know, I don't think that, you know, when people say that they're worried about sports betting taking, you know, racing spot in the online wagering hemisphere, I don't know that that's necessarily going to be the case for people who wouldn't bet racing ever. Like, you know, I think they were just going to go to sports no matter what. But in this case, where you have sports bettors who also bet the races, I think it might make them more inclined to lean towards sports betting the next time they lose to a guy that they think is cheated. I think that that's a real danger. And that's why I wanted to talk about this, because I think Michael Bachok speaks for a lot of horse players in that way. And I consider myself among them.
Yeah, I'd just like to bring up one other point here. I don't think they'll win the lawsuit either. But however, there is an interesting precedent to this. A couple of years back, a very similar thing happened in harness racing, where and the infraction from the trainer was more serious than anything Baffert had done. I believe the guy was caught blood doping and his horse was disqualified. And a harness bettor filed exactly the same sort of suit. My horse finished second. If your horse hadn't been juiced, I would have won, and I would have won whatever amount of money was. He actually got money out of it. I wrote about this for the TDN. I believe he got about $20,000. The trainer and the owner settled out of court. So I'm sure their lawyer said, look, you know, give the guy $20,000, he'll go away. If you don't, you're going to have to spend $50,000 paying me to go to trial with this. Now, the difference there is, you know, Bob Baffert has no problem. I assume Bob Baffert's a very wealthy man, and he doesn't need to, he's not going to settle out of court with a guy if the legal bills are going to pile up a little bit. I'm sure that he'll fight this. But it's not the first time this has happened. And again, the harness bettor did not win a lawsuit, but did get a pretty nice settlement from the person that they sued in there.
I was going to say, Randy, I was going to say Bob Baffert may be wealthy, but the longer this stuff goes on, Craig Robinson's going to be even wealthier. He's got a lot of lawsuits on his docket. Sorry, Randy, go ahead.
No. Just going to say, we could spend the rest of this whole podcast talking about the challenges that horse players face and the frustrations that they face trying to stay in the game and stick it out, right? The takeout, dwindling field size that suppresses the odds in races all around the country, the computer-assisted wagering, the fact that so much of the casual money has now been drained from the sport, with the casual racing fans playing casino games or sports betting or poker or whatever else, you name it. It's amazing that the sport is as healthy as it still is when you look at the wagering totals year after year after year. Yes, they've gone down, but still, there's a substantial amount of money bet in horse racing, and at least it gives encouragement that we can get the ship going in the right direction.
The TDN Writers Room was brought to you by Keeneland. Keeneland concluded its four-day January sale last Friday, saw 1,013 horses find new homes for a gross of over $46 million, second highest gross since their 2008 sale. The average dipped a little bit to $45,746, but the $20,000 median was up 33%. And a very good sign, the buyback rate was only 19.35%, down from over 21% last year. So that's always good news. Seems like the sales industry in general, RNAs are going down over the last year or so since we're starting to emerge from the pandemic. Keeneland has also announced the dates for its spring meeting, which I mentioned, which will run from April 8th through the 29th this year. It's featuring a bevy of stakes races, highlighted as always by the $1 million Toyota Bluegrass, which will be run April 9th. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
Maximum Security proves he's the real deal with a gate-to-wire win in the Florida Derby.
Champion three-year-old.
Maximum Security has won the TVG.com Haskell Invitational.
11 triple-digit buyers.
Maximum Security, he smoked them in the cigar mile.
Grade 1 winning four-year-old.
Maximum Security takes them all the way in the TVG Pacific Classic.
Secure your mare's future. Maximum Security.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Coolmore. Just this Monday, the first foal for champion three-year-old Maximum Security was born at Delridge Farm in Lexington when Pussyfoot, a full sister to Morning Line, foaled a Bay Filly bred by Gary and Mary West. Obviously, my favorite Coolmore stallion, Cupid. Got to mention him. Had two winners in 3 days this week when Valentina Day won her second straight at Turfway just 2 days after Love Her Lots was a winner at Gulfstream. Cupid's now the sire of 25 winners, including grade three winner God of Love stands for just $5,000 at Coolmore. At this point, you'd be stupid not to breed to him at that price. And Munnings became the leading sire of stakes winners in the new year when Fast Draw Munnings became his third black type winner in 2022, winning the Cal Cup Derby over at Santa Anita. So Coolmore Stallions definitely rolling. So we've had our big fish so far in the FBI indictments and the doping scandal was Jorge Navarro. And Bill, I was so jealous that you were there to see Jorge Navarro cry like a baby in court. I wish I would have loved to have been there. But then we had a couple other big fishes coming. We're past the defendants who have pled guilty phase now. Now is when the trials start. The people that chose to bring it to trial, including Jason Service, are going to go on trial in probably the next couple of months or so. The first trials start today, January 19th, with Seth Fishman and Lisa Gianelli, I think is her name. They were supposedly the manufacturers and distributors of PEDs, allegedly. So the government trials are going to start today. I'm curious what you guys think about, you know, are they going to get more time, you think, if they're found guilty than Jorge Navarro and the people who pled guilty did? I'm a little unclear on that and what the possible sentence time frame is. What do you think?
You know, I don't know, but my guess would be that it's not going to make any difference because, again, this judge has been throwing the book at everybody, you know, and so these are jury trials. So their guilt or innocence will be decided by a jury, but the sentencing will be done by the judge. And, you know, as I've said before, just being in that courtroom with her for the Navarro trial for a couple hours, I mean, she's a tough cookie and she's really gone hard on all these people. But it'll be interesting. Oh, first of all, a couple of things. I'm very surprised all these people are taking this to trial because back when this whole thing started and you know, and all the numbers and everything in my head are kind of jumbled up. But, you know, I remember writing about that like 95% of the people who take this to trial against the federal government are found guilty. And, you know, that the chances of getting off are just, you know, so slim. And then, you know, if you've been following the trial and understand all the evidence against these people, you know, the cases look to be extremely strong. So I think at the end of the day, Seth Fishman and Lisa Gianelli will be convicted in here and will wind up going to jail. You know, kind of, and T.D. Thornton wrote about this. One of the more interesting side notes to this is that Fishman hired this attorney, Mark Fernich, F-E-R-N-I-C-H, who I was told by a source his retainer is $500,000 just to get him to walk through the door. And, you know, he's apparently a huge deal. And his clients in the past have included El Chapo and Jeffrey Epstein. Now, you say, well, this guy is as good as it gets when it comes to defense attorneys. Can he get Fishman off? I don't think so. And last I checked, Jeffrey Epstein's dead and El Chapo's in jail for the rest of his life. So he didn't exactly do a great job for them now, did he?
Well, if Fishman indeed paid a $500,000 retainer to hire his lawyer, one of the interesting aspects of this is that he may not be listening to everything that his lawyer has advised, because this morning, right, Wednesday morning, Washington Post, there is an article on the front page of the sports section, I believe it's on the front page of the sports, in which Seth Fishman has talked to a Washington Post reporter. In the story, the person who wrote the article says that Fishman spoke to her against the advice of the attorney. The headline in that article, by the way, says, as his doping case goes to trial, Seth Fishman says, it's horse racing. That's corrupt. Now, we've seen many times in the past, the Washington Post is no friend of horse racing. So it's not surprising to read that kind of a headline coming out of the Washington Post. But the article is very interesting. When you read the article, you come away with the conclusion, even though it's the Washington Post, that there's very little chance that Fishman can beat this. It's going to be interesting to see what happens. As Bill pointed out, the judge, Mary Kay Vizcasil is her name. She was a former bankruptcy judge who was appointed by Donald Trump to this position at the U.S. District Court of the Southern District of New York back in 2019. Bill was at the Navarro trial. When you see, or the sentencing, when you read the transcripts of what Vizcasil said to Navarro and about Navarro at sentencing, it was unbelievably harsh. So it certainly would lead you to believe that whether it's a case that the defendants plead guilty, and we've had 9 that have pleaded guilty, 6 have been sentenced, and 3 are awaiting sentencing, or the ones that go to a jury trial, you certainly get the impression that Vizcasil is going to be giving him the maximum allowable sentence, regardless of whether they pled guilty or not.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story that starts with a tale of him taking care of the UAE Kingdom's camels. So this guy's a renaissance man when it comes to his veterinary practices. It's funny that you pay a guy a $500,000 retainer and then immediately go talk to the press against his wishes. That's a hell of a strategy to win a federal trial here. But yeah, I'm curious for this as kind of a bellwether to how the Jason Servais trial is going to go, because, you know, he had the chance to plead guilty. We talked about this before, you know, so many people changing their pleas to guilty. I thought, you know, kind of was it showed that they were going to try to implicate Jason Servais as the mastermind here and maybe a couple of these other guys as well. So that's what's interesting. And whether or not people are going to get more than the 5 years Jorge Navarro got, because 5 years, you know, it's a long time, especially for a federal sentence. But I don't know. It seems like there's something bigger coming down the pike for some of these other defendants, at least. But we'll keep tabs on that and keep you guys posted as developments warrant.
So one other little interesting point on this, if I can jump in, Joe, in that Washington Post article, this is not the first time that Seth Fishman has run afoul of the law. And he has cooperated in the past, apparently, according to this article, with law enforcement against other potential defendants. In this particular case, Fishman claims that the federal government wanted him to wear a wire and cooperate against Navarro, Servais, et cetera, et cetera. His quote was that he decided that wearing a wire would violate two of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not lie and thou shalt not bear false witness. So he said he decided to take his chance with a jury trial, and we'll see what happens.
But Randy, we all know what the 11th commandment is. Thou shalt not juice racehorses.
Thou shalt not claim off of Jason Servais or Jorge Navarro. That was definitely a commandment in racing for a little time. Yeah. Very pious, Seth Fishman, I'm sure. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Lane's End Farm. Lane's End Stallion of the Week this week is Union Rags. Union Rags is a sire of Express Train, winner of the Grade 2 San Antonio Stakes opening day at Santa Anita. Got up in the last stride to beat the big favorite, Hot Rod Charlie, who's on his way to Dubai. Express Train was a $500,000 Keeneland September yearling, whose earnings are now over $800,000. He's one of 13 greatest stakes winners for Union Rags today. That's a pretty damn good number. And on Friday, Spielberg, who was Union Rags' $1 million Keeneland September yearling, greatest stakes winning grade one placed. Spielberg made his first start since the Florida Derby last March and won an allowance race very impressively at Santa Anita. So look forward to seeing where he heads next. We'll be right back after this message from Lane's End.
Union Rags, proving Lane's End's tried and true stallion making formula. A formula that leads to success for our partners and our stallions. He's a leader in his sire crop by graded stakes winners and grade one winners. He's a commercial standout with multiple $1 million sales and a six-figure yearling average. And with four full books bred at 50 and 60,000, he has even more exciting progeny in the pipeline. Union Rags, a stallion that stands above the rest.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by XBTV. The XBTV workout of the week this week is this 5-furlong breeze, turned in by the very impressive Sham Stakes winner Newgrange, who's the horse on the outside here. He's tugging at his rider throughout the work. He edges past stablemate Pinehurst at the wire. Pinehurst, if you remember, was the winner of the Grade 1 Del Mar Futurity back in September. Newgrange is currently number 9 on T.D. Thornton's Derby Top 12 list at the TDN. The first editions of that have started to come out. So definitely Derby contenders. There's no better place to watch their workouts than XBTV. And you can watch them this early on the trail as well. You know, the workouts at Gulfstream, Palm Meadows, Santa Anita. So it's never too early to get involved in handicapping potential Derby contenders. And definitely go watch those replays if you're going to place a future bet or anything. And in that realm, go check them out on XBTV. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we are honored this week to bring on as the Green Group Guest of the Week, Kentucky State Representative Adam Koenig, who is introducing a bill to get rid of breakage and lots of other good stuff for racing in Kentucky. Adam, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So great to have you. And the more I read about you, the more I like that you're in the Kentucky State Legislature. Let's start with the breakage thing, because breakage has been a thorn in the side of horse players for a long time, seemingly for no reason, honestly. But can you just explain, for people who don't know, can you explain the history of where breakage laws come from and why they've been allowed to exist for so long?
Well, gosh, I think breakage laws go back so far that we can't even figure out when they were passed in Kentucky. But obviously, there was a time 100 years ago when it was the only place to go and legally make wagers was the racetrack. And so anybody that wanted to have some fun and make some wagers went and, you know, they had high attendance on a regular basis at the tracks. The lines were deep and it was something done to make it easier to cash people out. And of course, they didn't have computers to figure out how much was being wagered. They were, I guess, counting the money in the back and figuring out the odds and in real time by hand. So it probably also made it easier from that perspective to not get it all the way down to the penny. But obviously, we all know those days have come and gone, and it's time for our laws to reflect today's reality, and which is, you know, you can get paid. I get paid down to the penny and the rare occasion I hit a superfecta. So we should be able to do that for everything.
Well, Adam, again, it's great to hear somebody on your side of the fence, the politicians, talk about this, because as Joe said, this is something horse players have been complaining about for absolute years. So first of all, take us back. How did you first get this idea to approach this? And secondly, you know, read the political landscape for us. Are you confident that at the end of the day, this bill you're introducing will pass and we will see no breakage in Kentucky?
Well, the idea came. I'm a regular listener to of Steve Bick's show in the mornings, and I heard him have Pat Cummings on to talk about that and some of the other ideas from the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation. And I just kind of tucked that in the back of my mind. Later, Senator Damon Thayer, which probably everybody knows, he invited me to dinner with Pat Cummings and Craig Burnick to talk about all their issues. And now we're at a time when we have an opportunity to do something about it. This is going to be a comprehensive pari-mutuel wagering reform or modernization bill. And that's going to be one of the main parts of it. And thanks to she's called herself the free media maven, Jenny Reese. She's helped get this issue more attention. But we're going to do a lot in this bill. But breakage is certainly probably my favorite part of it as a guy who does wagering and nothing else in the business.
Well, it's great to hear an elected official who talks about how much he likes wagering. On the topic of the chances of getting it passed, now I went to YouTube yesterday and watched Kentucky Public Television debate, I think from last fall. I think that specifically was about historical horse racing, but you and Damon were on there. Some Democrats were on there. When we see Democrats and Republicans on the same stage politically, we're accustomed to seeing the flamethrowers come out, but there was an unusual amount of harmony, it seemed, between the two sides when the topic was horse racing. Is that something that's just unique to Kentucky because of the importance of horse racing to the sport? Can you talk about that cooperation a little bit there?
There are issues in Kentucky that aren't Republican and Democrat. They're urban and rural. And I chair the House Committee on Licensing, Occupations, and Administrative Regulations. And we, among other things, handle all things gambling and alcohol. So I get to deal with this on both those issues. These are urban-rural issues. So, you know, Democrats and Republicans generally agree on expanded gaming. I'm sorry, urban folks, which means Democrats and Republicans both tend to agree on expanded gaming and expanded alcohol. And I've led the charge on that, along with Senator Thayer, as well as a few others, Speaker Osborne, who's a breed horse breeder and owner. So we've worked collaboratively together, but obviously with the HHR bill that we passed last year, it was a very heavy lift. It had been the biggest change in Kentucky gambling law since we passed the lottery, I think, in 1988. So it was a heavy lift, and there was an agreement in order to get some of the votes to make sure that we were getting enough revenue for the general fund from these historical horse racing machines to look at the tax rate for that, and to Speaker Osborne and Senate President Stiver's credit, they said, why don't you just look at everything in parimutuel wagering? So we're going to change the tax rates on all wagers, because they go from 0.5% on ADWs to 3% on simulcast bets. Those are all going to be evened out. Everything's going to be 1.5%, which is what a live wager is, and also is what HHR is taxed at. And, you know, there's these underlying rates where some money goes to the Thoroughbred Development Fund, Standardbred Development Fund, University of Louisville program, several other things, that those tax rates were created, most of them by Senator Thayer over the years, that made sense at the time, may not make as much sense now. So some of them are going to be changed a little bit, but certainly we're going to make sure that we keep the success of the Thoroughbred Development Fund and the purse growth continuing to go up as and make Kentucky the place to not just breed as well as run your horses.
I want to ask you, because you're the lead sponsor on the on a sports betting bill as well in the Kentucky legislature, and you mentioned Jenny Reese. Shout out to Jenny Reese, who does a great job. She said that there might be some quote unquote safeguards for racing in that bill. Can you explain what that would mean?
The bill, as it's currently constructed, makes the track owners or the operators the ones that get the sports wagering license, and part of that is again an urban rural thing. There's a lot of urban or rural folks that might be willing to vote for it as long as you're not going to have a sports betting facility in there in your district, in their part of the world. So as long as it's kept to those urban areas and you don't have to see it, then it's easier for a few members to vote that way. So, and we're at the point where I think Indiana next door, 80% of their wagers are mobile. New Jersey, 90% of their wagers are mobile. So, you know, most of that wagering either way will take place on people's phones.
Adam, as you tackle breakage, the other big issue that horse players have such a problem with is the high takeout in the sport. And you talk about, you know, sports wagering, which has been so unbelievably successful as it's swept across the country. No surprise to anyone. One of the main reasons why it's more successful than horse racing betting is because the price is different. It's much, much lower. Is this ever something that a legislature could tackle so far as bringing takeout rates on horse racing down? And if not, how could that possibly happen in Kentucky? So, you know, I'm not saying get it equal to sports betting, but instead of maybe 20%, get it down to 13 or 14% or something like that.
Well, there are max takeouts in Kentucky statute, and I'm not going to change those in this bill. That is something that I would much rather see the market take care of and let our operators, CDI, Keeneland, Kentucky Downs, Ellis Park, figure it out how to make their product competitive going forward.
In any discussion legislatively about horse racing in Kentucky, we would always assume that the 300-pound gorilla in the room would be Churchill Downs Incorporated and Keeneland as well. Since any change in the breakage rules would take money out of the pockets of the racetracks in the ADWs like Twin Spires, can we assume that Churchill Downs is 100% on board with this?
Actually, I'm still working on the bill. Getting into those tax rates is not my specialty. So we haven't got it out there. I've briefed the operators in general on what I'm planning on doing. I've not yet received pushback. I'm sure I will. But yeah, look, I live 5 minutes from Turfway. They're building a beautiful facility there. They've got multiple facilities in Louisville. They've got one in Hoptown in a harness track. They're making plenty of money on the HHR facilities. And I think they can, certainly on the breakage front, they can stand to help out the bettors. As I said multiple times now, we've taken care of the tracks. We've taken care of the breeders and the trainers and the jockeys. And we need all of them to make the show run. We also need the bettors to make the show run. And by God, I'm going to take care of the bettors, not just because I'm one, but because we need to take care of those folks without whom we don't have an industry.
Can we multiply you by like 500 and put you in state legislatures across the country? Because
it's music. If only. If only.
It's music to my ears on the horse players front. I had a more general question. You talked, you know, you were instrumental in protecting HHR in Kentucky, which is a huge deal. And like you said, it was a heavy lift, and I'm sure it was. But I think Kentucky has a little bit of an advantage in that the sport is so woven into the fabric of the state. You had a lot of industry support for that bill as well. There are other states where, you know, legislatures and governors are trying to take away funds from racing. And I think that the public and the legislature are not as sympathetic to the sport as they may be in Kentucky. What would be your recommendations? Like, what kind of arguments would you suggest people make in other states about why racing needs to stick around?
Well, in Kentucky, we only have so many signature industries, so it's easier to point to the jobs, to the marketing, to the fact that when you go outside of Kentucky and you say, I'm from Kentucky, the first thing most people think of is the Kentucky Derby. And second thing they think of is bourbon nowadays, thankfully. So it's easier to make that argument and the jobs and the marketing in Kentucky. But in some of these other states, you know, you point to the jobs. And one thing I think that I work in a lot of these states is you point to the green space. This is, you know, areas that if you're environmentally sensitive legislator, you got your breeding programs, and that's just a bunch of open green space. That's good for the environment, creates high paying jobs, in many ways. And it is a great place for, folks who are new to the country to go and work. It's a good place to learn a good work ethic, no matter where you come from. And, you know, I don't know, it's just an enjoyable sport. And I think one thing that some of these states need to do is do a better job of getting their legislators to the big days. You know, we have to buy our tickets to the Derby and Oaks, but we get the opportunity to do that. And that's a big deal. You get people to Keeneland, you know, that's great. I don't know if California has ever made sure that they get their legislators to Del Mar, or if they New York folks have ever gotten their folks to Saratoga. But I think it's an opportunity for them to teach, if you will.
Adam, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for the work you're doing, especially in the Kentucky legislature. I'm sure horse players across the country, especially Kentucky, appreciate it. Good luck with the bill.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Adam.
Thanks, Adam.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Representative Adam Koenig will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
With some of the fullest fields in the country and quality racing year-round, there's never been a better time to reap the rewards of breeding and racing in Kentucky. purse money in Kentucky is at an all-time high, as is average purse per race, outpacing California, Florida, and New York. Kentucky Breds. Breed them. Raise them. Race them. We all win.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by the Kentucky Thoroughbred Owners and Breeders and Kentucky Breds. Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund, which we heard Representative Koenig talk about earlier, is a unique program to benefit owners and their Kentucky-sired, Kentucky-foaled runners. Its aim is to upgrade the overall quality of racing in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, which is a high bar, but always worth striving for. Eclipse Award nominations were announced this week. Not surprising to learn that 19 of the 30 horses up for championship honors are Kentucky Breds, which is 63%. Those include all three of the horses up for champion two-year-old filly, all three of those eligible for female sprinter, along with two-year-old colts, Corniche and Jack Christopher, and three-year-old males, Essential Quality and Life is Good. So probably going to be nearly a clean sweep for the Kentucky Breds at the upcoming Eclipse Awards. So we can do a topic on, we can do a segment on Flightline every single week. We almost did one last week. We did one the week before. This week, there was a little bit of news that came out. You know, John Sadler is starting to plot out a course and a strategy and a campaign for this year for Flightline, if you can call it that. So reportedly, he's going to run four times this year. He's in training right now. He's going to come back to regular workouts, I think, in the next couple of weeks. Sadler's looking for a spot for him in March, with the main goal in the first half of the year being the Met Mile, which is obviously a logical spot. You know, it's a tough thing because he's such a valuable horse. So I could get the economics of it. But I said this when we talked about him for the first time. We were kind of speculating. Who was it that said he's going to run seven or eight more times? John said that, Bill?
No way, dude.
Like, the over-under should be 4.5. It looks like it'll be under that. So I get it. I get like why you wouldn't want to risk him, you know, more than you have to. There's only so many prestigious races you can run one horse in, but it could be more than four. And he's the kind of horse that I think is so special and so potential, so generational. And just, you know, who's the last horse we saw that had this kind of talent? For me, it's Go Sapper. You know, Go Sapper didn't run a lot either. I think that was more because he had some physical issues. Flightline, as far as I know, is sound right now. And I just don't agree with not running a sound horse who can actually put asses in the seats and get people's eyeballs on racing and get people engaged and passionate about a horse. It drives me a little crazy how much in the money and the breeding money and the stallion money controls the industry, because, you know, if it wasn't such a big deal to get these horses to stud, I think you would see Flightline a lot more than four times this year. So that part is a little frustrating, but I guess we're just going to have to savor him when he gets on the track. What do you guys think?
Yeah, Joe, I mean, I'm right on board. We're on the same page. And, you know, John said seven or eight. Well, you know, he should run 9 or 10 times this year, even seven or eight. You know, is nothing, and is nothing compared to what horses did, you know, not even just in the 1950s, but, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. So it's going to be a prep for the Met Mile, put him back in bubble wrap, a prep for the Breeders' Cup Classic, which he said would either be the Pacific Classic or the Whitney. I'm guessing that he's going to come back in the San Carlos, because I don't think you'd want to run, which is a 7-furlong race. I don't think you'd want to run beyond a mile, then come back and run a mile in the Met Mile. You know, look, I've been yelling and screaming about this as much as anybody and for the longest time. And it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. But I get it. I mean, John Sadler's job is not to win race A, B, C, D, or to make sure that there's an extra 10,000 people in the stands when he runs in the Whitney at Saratoga or something like that. It is to make the horse as valuable as possible as a sire. And he's taking that job seriously, and he obviously thinks this is the way to do it. And unfortunately, he's probably not wrong. You don't want to get the horse beat. You want to pick all the right spots, give him as much time in between. So I get it. If I owned him, maybe I would do that too. I don't know, despite it would be kind of hypocritical after all the things I've said over the years. But I get it. But, you know, someday we all need to sit down and get in a room, and again with all the racing leaders, say, how are we going to put a stop to this sort of thing? You know, even a $20 million purse in Saudi Arabia is not enough to entice him to run in that race. $20 million. Nope, can't do that. Not going to run for $20 million. We'll see, you know, four more times and goodbye. So it's, you know, it's what it is. It's kind of sad, but it is the state of things. And I don't know what anybody can do about it.
We've talked about it so often over the years. I mean, I voted for him for champion sprinter. I mean, he's an amazing horse. I thought his Malibu was just unbelievable. You mentioned Ghost Sapper. I had a conversation in a tack room at Churchill Downs more than 20 years ago with Bobby Frankel, who told me that he borrowed the idea from Charlie Whittingham that if you run horses frequently, you top horses, right? You'll get an A-level performance. And if you give them extra time between races, and sometimes a lot of extra time, you can turn that A into an A+. And that was Bobby Frankel's mantra. It's been Todd Pletcher's mantra. You know, it's now standard operating procedure for trainers around the country. And there's another aspect to this as well. Trainers are loath to admit it because so many of them train for breeders. But almost all of them, to a person, believe that the thoroughbred is inherently less robust nowadays than the thoroughbreds of old. And in particular, they believe that horses that are incredibly fast, and Frankel told me this about Ghost Sapper as well, are harder on themselves physically than horses that aren't that fast, right? So with Flightline in particular, he's so incredibly fast. He's already had one issue. When he broke his maiden at Santa Anita, he came out of that race with a foot abscess. And I think Sadler is concerned that if he runs him more often than that, that he's so hard on himself because he's so freaking fast that it's going to make it difficult to get even those, you know, four races out of him. Hopefully we get to see him run those four races and he doesn't wind up on the shelf. But if we just get four, then I think you're right, Joe. We're just going to have to enjoy a generational talent because he's an incredible horse.
Yeah, he's amazing. And I get what you're saying, but just watching him run, he seems very easygoing. He seems like a very easy strider, but obviously the internal mechanisms of the horse could be different than what we're seeing on the racetrack. You know, I think it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy where you run horses less frequently, you baby them more, they do become a little less robust over time, whether or not they actually, you know, were meant to run that infrequently. I think it becomes this thing where it becomes accepted conventional knowledge and conventional strategy that you then perpetuate, not only the idea that the thoroughbreds are weaker and less robust than before, but you kind of can contribute to that as well because you take them off the track for the slightest little thing. And you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, I know one would say too many positive things about Ahmed Zayat these days, but I thought, you know, American Pharoah's campaign as a 3-year-old kind of should have been the template for what you should do with a horse who's that popular and that good. Now, Flightline's popularity is not going to reach American Pharoah's level because he didn't have those, he hasn't run those breakthrough popular races like the Derby and the Belmont and the Preakness. But as far as for racing fans, I feel like he's almost as popular as American Pharoah. And, you know, as long as he's sound and is, you know, training regularly, I don't see why you shouldn't feel at least a little bit of compulsion to bring him out and to showcase him to the racing world. But, you know, like Bill says, we get the economics of it. We're not naive. We get why, you know, he's only going to run a couple times this year, and we'll look forward to him whenever he does run. But, you know, it sucks. It sucks to feel like no matter how good of a horse we get to see, we're never going to get to see that kind of full campaign from a superstar horse anymore. And, you know, it's just the way of the world now in racing, unfortunately. Tough to segue from that into this, but there was some news this week or last week on the front of Belmont and Saratoga renovations. Now, we heard about some of this last year. We talked to David O'Rourke when we were up at Saratoga for our 100th show about potential changes coming to the Naira tracks. Last Friday, T.D. Thornton reported in the TDN that the construction of vehicle and pedestrian tunnels that cut underneath all three racing services at Belmont could necessitate running the 22 autumn meeting at Aqueduct instead of Belmont. We've heard about this tunnel that they're building for a while. It's part of a larger project to winterize Belmont Park. I think they're also going to put in a synthetic track eventually at Belmont, which I think is the way of the future. You know, we've seen Gulfstream put in the Tapeta track this past year, and it really, I think, has been a success. You know, the turf races when they come off still mainly stay together, and it's been decent racing. Honestly, it hasn't just been a place for cheap horses. But Belmont's going to get in on that, and Naira is going to get in on that, and I think is going to have a better chance to compete in the winter against the Gulfstreams and the Fairgrounds and the Tampas of the world if they winterize Belmont Park. I think it makes all the sense in the world. The other news in this story was that they're going to construct a one-mile chute at Saratoga, which is interesting because at this point they can't run any dirt races between 7 furlongs and 1 1/8 miles. So that's been a little bit of a bugaboo, especially when you have races that are 1 1/16 miles come off the turf. They usually run them at 1 1/8 miles, which is very hard to get a bunch of turf horses to run 1 1/8 miles on dirt, especially over a really tiring track, which Saratoga is. So I think that that'll help field size as well. And overall, it's just great to see NYRA taking these proactive steps to try to improve the racing product, to try to make it a better year-round racing product. You know, it might end in the demise of my beloved Aqueduct, and that'll be a shame because, you know, not many people love Aqueduct, but I do. But nevertheless, I think it makes sense to make NYRA competitive all year round and to keep field size big. Because we talked about this, you know, with the handle numbers. The handle numbers were so positive. The real negative was the continuing decline in field size. I think we're down to like 7.3, the average field size in America. So I think this is designed to at least help that at the NYRA tracks. I wonder if Bill or Randy have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, Joe, I mean, it's not just about tomorrow or a year from now or 2 years from now. You know, we're getting in drips and drabs a better look and feel for where the New York Racing Association intends to take things. And yes, your aqueduct is done. It might be five years now or 10 years now. But if you think about it, you know, why you love aqueduct so much is a conversation for another day. And but you know, the two tracks are 8 miles apart. It doesn't make any sense to have two right now. And I'm sure Resorts World would pay a fortune for the rest of that track to build even more casinos and have more slot machines, yada, yada, yada. But, you know, again, whether it's 5 years now for 10 years from now, I think we're going to see Belmont run all year except when Saratoga is running. For the winter, they need a track conducive to doing that. That would be the synthetic surface. And then the other issue is, you know, what about the building? You know, and they haven't really said precisely what they're going to do, but there's going to have to be some changes. And the possibilities are you take the existing building and, you know, do a lot of renovations, or you just tear the thing down and start all over again. I mean, you only need that building one day a year for the Belmont stakes, and you may not even need it that big unless a horse is going for the Triple Crown. So I think the pedestrian tunnel into the infield, that's a place they can put people on Belmont Stakes Day with tents and everything for the infield if they do build a smaller track, which is a smaller grandstand. And then the other question, will they keep the 1.5 miles circumference of Belmont Park? I think by and large, they lose out by having 1.5 miles track. I think 1 1/8 miles would make a lot more sense. But are they going to do that? We don't really know. So, you know, it's very interesting where this is all headed. But, you know, it's clear there's no time frame on this. But, you know, things are finally heating up when they say that they might run the Belmont meet in 2022 at Aqueduct. Then we know things are starting to change. And I think, you know, when it's all said and done, we'll look back at this and say they were changes for the better.
And as far as the 1 mile shoot at Saratoga, Joe, I guess you're saying I can take all of my trainer stats, 7 furlongs to 1 1/8 miles, and just throw them out the window, right? I won't need those anymore.
Yeah, I wonder why they, you know, it seems like they run the 1 1/16 miles races at 1 1/8 miles on the dirt when they're off the turf for no reason, because when it's two-year-olds, they take it back to 7 furlongs. Why couldn't you just run those races at 7 furlongs instead of 1 1/16 miles? Anyway, that was a quirk of Saratoga that's going away, and I think it makes more sense for a variety of racing and for field size as well. So shout out to NYRA. I think that they're doing a lot of good things on these fronts, on renovation, Belmont, on Aqueduct, and Saratoga. And Bill, I just like Aqueduct because it was the first track I went to, and I can get there by subway, which I like. As a born and bred Brooklynite, I don't have to go on the LIRR. I don't have to get in a car. I can just hop on the A train, and I'm there in 20 minutes. So foreign concept to the central New Jersey denizens of the TDN, but yeah, that's why I like it.
I never had that issue at Oaklawn Park either, by the way.
Is there a subway right to Oaklawn?
Not quite.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com Eclipse.com. And this week, Flightline was nominated for the Eclipse Award for Champion Sprinter. You know, it was a dominating campaign, even though he only ran three times. We talked about John Sadler pointing him to a race in March or April before taking aim at the Met Mile. Randy mentioned something interesting in the previous segment when we talked about him, that he voted for him for Eclipse Champion Sprinter. I'm guessing you hadn't voted for a horse like that who had only run three times before, but what was your reasoning?
I can't remember, Joe. I can't remember voting for a horse with such a limited campaign for an Eclipse Award. But when you look at the competition, I mean, Aloha West, the Breeders' Cup Sprint would be, I guess, the most logical choice conventionally, what you would normally do. But I didn't think the Breeders' Cup Sprint was an especially strong race at all. Dr. Scheibel came back and didn't run very well. So,
Jackie's Warrior?
What's that?
Jackie's Warrior?
Jackie's Warrior, I put second. And it, to me, it came down between Flightline and Jackie's Warrior. But I thought Flightline's race in the Malibu was just so off the charts, just even better than some of Jackie's Warrior's best races. So despite the fact that he had a very limited campaign, I chose Brilliance, what I thought was the most brilliant performance of the year, maybe the two most brilliant performances of the year, actually. And I put Flightline number one on my ballot. I don't expect him to win, though.
No, but I don't think you're going to be alone on that. I think he's going to get definitely a decent amount of first place votes. So how much does it cost to own a racehorse like Flightline with West Point? Costs less than you might think. Download the free report on westpointtv.com. You can learn West Point horses have now earned over $60 million in purses and won close to 1,000 races. And their Black and Gold Fund for racehorse retirement provides security for their runners when their racing careers are over. So shout out to West Point. They do a lot of great things and always doing right by the horses as well. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills, fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up and down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. Catalog for the Facing Tipton February sale is now out. Legacy Bloodstock will offer a consignment of six horses, including a two-year-old filly by Bodie Meister, selling as a racing prospect, Short Yelling by Summerfront from the family of Lucayan Prince, and a Street Sense colt from the family of Grade 1 winner Flat Fleet Feet. Got that one out. Visit LegacyBloodstockLLC.com to find out more. All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. A reminder that the Keeneland Spring Meet, the schedule is out right now. It starts April 8th and runs through April 29th. I want to thank Bill Finley, our very special guest co-host Randy Moss, our producer Patty Wolf, our associate producer Katie Petruniak, and our editors Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you all so much for watching. I won't see you next week, but Bill and someone, maybe another guest co-host, we'll see you next week. Thanks for watching.